under an ergonomic analysis. And then just a lot of articles that could be found by searching my name in the published data. So I think it helps to be able to read French, because we do publish a lot in French, but it's there's a lot of stuff out there in English. And then Ellen Balka here in Vancouver is doing similar work, and you could also talk to her about what she's doing.
As a matter of fact, I have.
Thank you very much. And that was Karen Messing, Professor of Biology and Ergonomics at the University of Montreal at Quebec. Ellen Balka, whom you just heard mentioned, is a professor in communications at Simon Fraser University in the Vancouver area. I interviewed her for CJSF-FM, the campus community radio station of that university. Balka told me that nurses have to develop workarounds to compensate for the design deficiencies of hospital technologies. When new technologies, for example, a drug dispensing machine, are introduced, they seldom take into account how the equipment will fit into the specific hospital setting and the existing routines. This can lead to new problems and perhaps cause unexpected mistakes. Please let your favorite radio station know that you enjoy hearing programs from WINGS. Thanks to Kelly Ramirez for editing and research on this two-part series about the work of Karen Messing. If you missed part one, check our archives at www.wings.org. WINGS thanks our supporters, including your local radio station, Suzette Cullen and Genevieve Vaughn, author of 36 Steps to a Gift Economy and Forgiving, a Feminist Criticism of Exchange. The WINGS sound logo is from Libana's album, A Circle is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Is Democracy Now.
Spot market is very tricky. I was watching it, but if you look at it now, it's beautiful. The bond market right now is beautiful. But I saw last night where people were getting a little queasy.
Hours after President Trump imposed tariffs on much of the world, provoking global outrage, he reversed course, back down on his global trade war, with one major exception, China. While Trump paused the latest tariffs for most countries for 90 days, he increased tariffs on Chinese imports to 125%. We'll speak to two economists, Nancy Chen at Northwestern University and the Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz at Columbia. Plus, we look at President Trump's latest threats to bomb Iran just days before the U.S. and Iran hold talks in Oman. And we speak to Holocaust scholar, Columbia professor Marianne Hirsch. She recently wrote a piece headlined, "I Grew Up Under a Terrifying Authoritarian Regime. Mahmoud Khalil's arrest is right out of their playbook." All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The European Union's just announced it's pausing retaliatory tariffs on the U.S. one day after Trump abruptly lowered his so-called reciprocal tariffs on most countries for 90 days, just hours after they took effect Wednesday. Most U.S. trading partners will now see a blanket 10% tariff in addition to the previously imposed 25% tariffs on cars, steel and aluminum. But China was not spared in Trump's sudden U-turn. Beijing now faces a hiked-up total tariff of 125% in retaliation for Beijing enacting an 84% levy on U.S. goods Wednesday. Markets rallied following the announcement after days in free fall. Trump told reporters he made the decision to halt the tariffs yesterday morning because people were, quote, getting a little bit yippy. But Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent claimed the move was part of Trump's larger plan to create maximum negotiating leverage.
It took great courage for him to stay the course until this moment. And what we have ended up with here, as I told everyone a week ago, they are in this very spot. Do not retaliate, and you will be rewarded.
Earlier on Wednesday, House Republicans deployed a rare procedural maneuver to block a Democratic measure that sought to force a vote on repealing Trump's tariffs by challenging his national emergency powers. We'll have the latest on Trump's tariffs after headlines with the Nobel Prize-winning economist Joe Stiglitz and the Northwestern economist Nancy Chen. The Palestinian Health Ministry says the death toll from an Israeli missile attack Wednesday on Gaza City's Shujaiya neighborhood has killed at least 35 people, with a death toll expected to rise. At least 55 people are wounded and as many as 80 others still trapped under the rubble. Victims, including children, some of them torn to pieces as multiple missiles struck a residential block where Israel later claimed a senior Hamas fighter was staying without naming them or providing evidence. The killings came as Haaretz reported Israel's army is preparing to incorporate the southern city of Rafah and surrounding neighborhoods into a buffer zone along Gaza's border. Rafah comprises about 17% of Gaza's territory. Before October 2023, it was home to some 200,000 Palestinians. It's now largely deserted after Israel in late March once again ordered the mass expulsion of the residents of Rafah. Nearly 40 days after Israel shattered the ceasefire and reimposed a near-total blockade on aid shipments, prices for food, fuel, medicine, and other essential goods are skyrocketing in Gaza. The UN says 60,000 children are at risk of malnutrition, with people forced to forage for food as community kitchens run out of food.
I swear to God, if we don't die from airstrikes, we will die of hunger. We are not safe. The whole world, listen to us. We are really not safe. We move from one soup kitchen to another with danger. I swear to God, they are striking everywhere. If I don't die in these strikes, I will die of hunger with my children. What shall we do? Where shall we go? Look at us. Find us a solution. We've been in this torture for a year and a half. We are tired.
French President Emmanuel Macron said in an interview this week with that France might soon formally recognize a Palestinian state, with a decision expected in June. Meanwhile, the United States Senate Wednesday confirmed former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee as U.S. Ambassador to Israel. Huckabee is a far-right Christian Zionist who's openly advocated for Israel's annexation of Palestinian lands and has said, quote, there's really no such thing as a Palestinian, unquote. Yemen's Houthis say U.S. airstrikes overnight killed three people in the rebel-held Yemeni capital Sana'a. The strikes follow a U.S. attack Tuesday on the port city of Hodeidah that reportedly killed 13 people and injured 15 others. Houthi officials said most of the dead were women and children. The U.S. has been carrying out near-daily strikes on Yemen's Iran-backed Houthis since March 15th. Meanwhile, the Trump administration has levied new sanctions against Iran, targeting its uranium enrichment program. The ratcheted up sanctions come ahead of negotiations over Iran's nuclear program scheduled to take place in Oman on Saturday. This week, President Trump threatened that if the talks don't go well, quote, Iran is going to be in great danger. We'll have more on Iran later in the broadcast. The Trump administration says its reverse cuts in emergency food aid to several nations after the World Food Program blasted the cuts as a death sentence for millions of people facing extreme hunger and starvation. USAID Acting Deputy Administrator Jeremy Lewin, a member of Elon Musk's Doge team, reportedly ordered staff to resume assistance to the World Food Program in Lebanon, Syria, Somalia, Jordan, Iraq, and Ecuador. But those countries do not include Afghanistan and Yemen, two countries with dire humanitarian situations that have been ravaged by U.S. intervention. In related news, the nonprofit Save the Children says eight people in South Sudan, including five children, died last month as they were forced to walk for 3 hours to seek medical care for cholera after U.S. aid cuts shuttered local health services. South Sudan's grappling with a worsening political crisis, which has stoked fears of a renewed civil war. Federal judges in Texas and New York have temporarily blocked the removal of U.S. residents under the Alien Enemies Act, an 18th century wartime law invoked by President Trump to fast track the expulsion of immigrants he's accused of being gang members. Both judges said any targets for removal must be able to have their cases heard in court. Trump expelled 238 people from the U.S. without due process in March, the vast majority from Venezuela. They've effectively disappeared into El Salvador's notorious mega prison, SECAT. Despite the Trump administration's claims it's targeting violent criminals, data shows 90% of those removed in last month's flight had no criminal record. In Venezuela, families of the removed individuals rallied outside a UN office in Caracas to call for the release of their loved ones.
I want to ask with my heart and my hands for them to give us back our children. We Venezuelans are very united. Our priority is our family. If we are missing one, we are missing everything. That is the only thing we need. Please give us back our children.
The Trump administration Wednesday said it's looking into a possible legal pathway to transfer U.S. citizens to El Salvador's notorious SECAT prison. In other immigration news, U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services says it started screening social media activity of immigrants for evidence of so-called anti-Semitic activity that could be used to deny benefits, including permanent residency status. Jewish groups spoke out against the new policy. The group Bend the Arc Jewish Action says it's, quote, using Jews as an excuse to move a cruel anti-immigrant authoritarian agenda, unquote. The pro-Israel group J Street said, quote, the fight against anti-Semitism won't be advanced by attacks on 250-year-old cherished American rights like free speech, unquote. Germany's incoming Chancellor Friedrich Merz announced on Wednesday his center-right Christian Democratic Union made a deal to form a governing coalition with the center-left Social Democrats. The deal shuts out the extreme-right party Alternative for Germany, which had come in second place in February elections. He said Germany would boost its military spending and vowed to enact more hardline immigration policies.
As for migration, we will pursue a new approach. We will better organize and steer, and we will all but end illegal migration. There will be border checks and rejections of asylum requests. We will start a deportation program.
Doctors Without Borders is calling for immediate action after identifying cases of malnourished children in an asylum seeker camp on the Greek island of Samos. The group said six children from Syria and Afghanistan between the ages of 6 months and 6 years have been diagnosed with acute malnutrition and required urgent care. A quarter of the camp's residents are children. Mexico's demanding the United States respect its national sovereignty after NBC News reported President Trump is considering drone strikes on Mexican drug cartels. President Claudia Sheinbaum spoke Tuesday.
We reject any of these actions, and we also do not believe they will occur, because there is a lot of dialogue on security issues and many other topics. So no, not in Mexico.
Speaker Mike Johnson delayed a vote Wednesday on a Trump and Senate-approved budget framework after he failed to gain sufficient support from his Republican caucus. House Republicans want to enact $2 trillion in spending cuts to offset tax cuts for the very wealthiest. Democrats oppose the budget. This is Massachusetts Congressmember Jim McGovern.
It is a budget that will hurt working families. It is a budget that will especially hurt families who are struggling in poverty. Republicans have succeeded in putting together a Marie Antoinette budget, helping the richest of the rich while hurting the poorest of the poor. Let them eat cake. That is the Republican motto. And I've never seen such cruelty contained in a budget in all my years here.
President Trump has instructed the Justice Department to stop the enforcement of state climate laws. Trump's sweeping executive order seeks to gut California's cap and trade program to limit carbon emissions, as well as climate superfund laws like New York and Vermont's requirement that major fossil fuel companies help cover the costs of extreme weather events. In a statement, the climate action group, the Sunrise Movement, said, quote, this is corruption at its most blatant. Last spring, Trump told oil and gas billionaires that if they gave his campaign $1 billion, he would do their bidding. The money flowed, and now they're cashing in, they said. And in related news, Trump has signed several executive orders seeking to boost U.S. coal production and consumption, declaring, quote, we're bringing back an industry that was abandoned, unquote. The United Nations has called the continued burning of coal and other fossil fuels incompatible with human survival. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, hours after President Trump imposed tariffs on much of the world, he reversed course and backed down on his global trade war, with one major exception, China. We'll have more on this with two leading economists. Stay with us.
I got handed an Ayn Rand sandwich straight from the can. It tasted so bland. I asked a lass to pass me a glass of Engels Conditions of the Working Class. Right away they dragged me to the committee to explain my un-American activity. They're gonna see.
Have the music by They Might Be Giants. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Nermeen, before we begin, I shared our condolences with our global audience a few weeks ago when your dad passed. We all mourn the loss of Najmuddin Sheikh, the former foreign minister of Foreign Secretary of Pakistan, and our condolences to you and your family.
Thank you so much, Amy. Thank you, Amy, and to everyone at Democracy Now! For your support in these last weeks. Global stock markets surged on Wednesday after President Trump announced a 90-day pause on sweeping new tariffs for most countries, while at the same time escalating the U.S. trade war with China. Trump raised tariffs on China to 125% after China increased tariffs on U.S. goods to 84% following the Trump administration's initial tariff increases. China has also taken other retaliatory actions, including new restrictions on rare earth exports to the U.S. As for most of the rest of the world, a 10% tariff remains in place, but the more sweeping tariffs were paused just hours after going into effect. Global stock markets had been tumbling ever since Trump announced the new tariffs on April 2nd, on what he called Liberation Day.
The Trump administration's given conflicting accounts as to why Trump reversed course. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent said it was Trump's, quote, strategy all along. But Trump himself openly admitted he was concerned about the unraveling of the U.S. bond market.
Bond market is very tricky. I was watching it, but if you look at it now, it's beautiful. The bond market right now is beautiful. But I saw last night where people were getting a little queasy. I think everything had... the big move wasn't what I did today. The big move was what I did on Liberation Day.
On Wednesday, the S&P 500 soared 9.5% and the Nasdaq jumped over 12% after Trump made his announcements about the tariff pause in a post on Truth Social just before 1:30 p.m. Earlier in the day, Trump wrote, quote, this is a great time to buy, DJT. Democratic Senator Adam Schiff is now calling on Congress to determine whether the Trump administration engaged in insider trading or market manipulation. Bloomberg is reporting the world's richest people added $304 billion to their combined net worth on Wednesday, the largest one-day gain in the history of the Bloomberg Billionaires Index.
We're joined now by two guests. From Rome, Italy, Nancy Chen is with us. She's a professor of economics at Northwestern University, co-director of Northwestern University's Global Poverty Research Lab, founding director of the China Econ Lab. Her latest piece for Project Syndicate is headlined, Americans Can't Win from Trump's Trade War. Joseph Stiglitz is with us in studio here in New York, Nobel Prize-winning economist, Columbia University professor, former chair of the Council of Economic Advisors. Professor Stiglitz is also currently the chief economist of the Roosevelt Institute. His latest book, The Road to Freedom, Economics and the Good Society. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Professor Stiglitz, let's begin with you. Just overall respond to this roller coaster. And if anyone has any doubt that global outcry matters and protests around the globe make a difference, like what happened this weekend, well, just take a look at what happened yesterday. Can you talk about, Professor Stiglitz, your response?
There's been total chaos. And one of the things that we know is that chaos is bad for the market. But there's been already lasting damage. You know, for the last 80 years, we were trying to create a world where a borderless world, at least borders mattered less. Mm. All of a sudden, borders matter more. Mm. And it's not only borders with those you don't like, it's borders with our best friends in Canada. So this is a new world where every country has to ask a question that we never asked before. What is the extent of our national economic sovereignty? Mm. What will happen if some crazy person in another country, in the United States, for instance, would suddenly raise tariffs 20%, 10%, 20%, 50%, 100%? So there is no reliability in our relationships, whether with friend or not so friend. What is also clear is that Trump has no economic theory behind what he's doing. And I think that's most disturbing, both to me as an economist and to those who are on the other side in negotiations. I've talked to some of these people and they say, you know, we don't know how to negotiate because the other side is not a normal negotiator. You know, normally the other side knows what they want. There's a theory about how trade works. That's not true here. It's a different world. So let me give you an example. Trump thinks that trade deficits by themselves, and in particular trade deficits in goods, reflect somebody treating us unfairly. And it's based sort of on a premise that we are better than any other country, so people should be buying more goods from us than we are buying from them. It's absurd. The net magnitude of the multilateral trade deficit is just determined by the disparity between aggregate savings on the one hand and national savings and aggregate national demand investment on the other. And if savings goes down, then we'll have a bigger deficit. Now, his proposal to have a big tax cut, unfunded, is effectively a lowering of national savings. And that's going to make the multilateral trade deficit larger. Mm. Then you look at the microeconomics. I just want to make sure he makes a big difference between goods and services. But we are in the 21st century, not where we were in 1950. Services are the major part of our economy. Goods production, manufacturing, is 9-10%. What are important? Service sector, tourism, education, health. What is he doing to those sectors? Look what he's done in the last few weeks. He's devastated our education system. The way his border immigration people have treated those wanting to come into our country with valid passport visas has discouraged tourism. So he is hell-bent at hurting America's major export industry, tourism, and education. So he's making things just that much more worse in at the micro level and at the macro level.
So before I bring in Professor Nancy Chan, I wanted to ask you, you just said earlier that chaos is bad for the market, indisputable, but how do you explain, people are absolutely perplexed, we had that in the introduction as well, how is it that just as Trump declared a pause on these tariffs, the market soared? And not just soared, I mean, for the biggest daily gain since 2008, the S&P, what explains
but
that?
But remember, the market had gone down enormously, almost into bear territory, in the two preceding days.
Yeah.
There is a lot of irrational exuberance at times in the market. My judgment is that they've made a mistake. And the reason I think there's a mistake is the importance of trade with China in many ways is much larger than trade with Europe. That we depend enormously for goods coming from China.
Yeah.
You know, we buy cars from Europe. If we don't have the European cars, you know, we suffer a little bit, but it's not a big deal. If we don't have the ingredients that go into so many of our goods, or if those ingredients go up twice in price, that's a big disturbance.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm anticipating that there will be actually a very big disturbance from these enormous, unprecedented, let me emphasize, unprecedented tariffs against China. And China's retaliation, including their restrictions on exports of minerals and rare earths that we need for our production.
Mm-hmm. So, Professor Nancy Chan, if we could get you to respond to the scale of these tariffs and what you think the impact on the Chinese economy and also the U.S. economy will be on these 125% that the U.S. has imposed on China and 84% that China has imposed on the U.S.
Like Professor Stiglitz said, these tariff rates are unprecedented. They are so high, it's really difficult for us to calibrate exactly what the cost will be on everyone, except that we know it's going to be enormous. You know, already we're seeing contracts that are being canceled between Chinese suppliers and American importers. Business relationships that took decades to build are now being paused because these tariffs are so high that no one can be profitable, can stay in business, and continue to import. And, you know, the thing about tariff rates is if you increase it a little bit, then maybe people can take the hit. By people, I mean, you know, the firms, the exporters and the importers. But if you increase it a lot and they can't meet their bottom line, then they just have to stop. And we've just never seen anything like this before. And what does it mean for the U.S. if we can't get parts from China? Mm-hmm. And also, what does it mean for China if they have to shut factories that are supporting families, you know, and children that were relying on these export jobs? So I think the cost for both economies is going to be colossal. We'll see a little bit of it in the short run. And if this continues, we're just going to see it exponentiate over time.
Let me ask you, Professor Chen, about the Treasury Secretary Bessent's comments when he said, you know, this was all planned. The question is, of course, was insider trading planned? Trump boasted yesterday the greatest increase in the stock market that the country it had ever seen. And, of course, the question is how these billionaires and perhaps, I can't say this, I know this, I don't know this, that Trump himself benefited yesterday as it rose, buying early. But Bessent's comment, you might even say Trump goaded China and they show themselves to be the bad actor that they are. Your comment, Professor Chen. I think we just lost Professor Chen in Rome, Italy, so we'll put that question to Professor Stiglitz.
Well, I don't think they anticipated this kind of response. The kind of language they used was a schoolyard bully. It was, they didn't show us respect. And, of course, China's view was U.S. broke international economic law. We have an international framework, the WTO, that is supposed to determine how countries determine trade policy. And we just threw that whole agreement that we played a key role in writing. We threw it in the dustpan. So the argument that, oh, he didn't show me respect is the kind of language you hear from bullies. I don't think we expected them to act so respondently. I was in China about 2 weeks ago, and it was very clear that they were ready for another round, because they had seen how erratic Trump was. And there is a fundamental asymmetry that I think Trump and his team doesn't fully grasp. The asymmetry is that China will experience a deficiency in aggregate demand as they lose their exports. You can shift that demand to producing domestically. And they've been trying to do that for a number of years. And this is going to move much harder to shift supply. Yeah. So we are in a tighter bind, I think, than China.
So Professor Chen is back with us. Professor Chen, that comment of the Treasury Secretary that this was all planned and that Trump successfully managed to goad China so that they would show themselves to be the bad actors that they are. And Vance's comment the day before, referring to the Chinese peasants.
It's really hard to believe that all of this was planned as a strategy to get to China, for a bunch of different reasons. One is, the unique adversarial relationship between China and the U.S. is well known, and it's been going on since the first trade war. So there's really no new information to be learned. The second is that the Chinese and the U.S. had actually been negotiating, and the Chinese had shown themselves to be really willing to negotiate and really not desiring a trade war. So you see that, for example, in the negotiations over the TikTok deal. So under the Biden administration, it was TikTok was asked to divorce itself from its Chinese owner's ByteDance. At the time, the Chinese government said, no way, we'll never let ByteDance sell TikTok to Americans. But then under the Trump administration, what we saw was that, the negotiations proceeded quite rapidly. And 2 days before it became official, that's when the U.S. hiked up tariffs on China to another 34%. So that just doesn't feel like a well-planned strategy. Another way to ask it is to say, well, what has the U.S. government achieved now that it couldn't have achieved without raising tariffs for the entire world, right? What did it achieve by increasing tariffs for islands with only penguins on it? What was the point of that? Did that tell anyone anything about American strength or about China? And the answer has to be no.
There's that cartoon going around. First, they came for the cats. Then they came for the penguins. They're mean.
I wanted to ask about the broader implications of what it would mean for a massive cut in trade between the U.S. and China. The World Trade Organization said Wednesday that this escalating tariff war could cut trade in goods between the two countries by 80%, and trade between China and the U.S. accounts for 3% of global trade, all global trade. So what would that mean? What are the fallout effects of that on other countries, much smaller economies? Professor Stiglitz's point that you made about the U.S. having broken international economic law, Bernie Sanders issued a statement yesterday saying that what he's done is actually unconstitutional, that Trump does not have the authority to impose the tariffs that he has. So if you could comment on both those things.
So let me begin by first emphasizing there's going to be a big economic effect on the United States, because the time it takes to bring manufacturing back in the United States, even if he were successful, is not 3 months, not even a year, 2 years. I've talked to firms that have thought about bringing manufacturing back to the United States. They say we don't have the logistics, we don't have the supply chains that you need to bring complex manufacturing back. And modern manufacturing is robotic. So even if we brought manufacturing back, there are not going to be many jobs. So the reality is that his picture of bringing us back to the 1950s, that's never going to happen. But what's going to happen in the meanwhile? We're not going to be able to get those goods that Americans want. We saw what happened when the supply chains got interrupted after the pandemic and after the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Prices soared, some goods more than others. And that's the world we're going to be back in. That's going to affect, of course, not only the United States, but every other country. If the Fed acts like it normally does, when prices go up, it raises interest rates, we're going to go back into stagflation.
Who is Trump's ear? I mean, you've got the trade whisperer, Peter Navarro, right, who was, you know, top economic trade guy in the first administration, then went to prison, is now out, and continually cites the economist Ron Vero for why it's important to trade to impose tariffs. And it turns out that Ron Vero is just an anagram of Navarro. He doesn't even exist. You can't make this stuff up. And now, of course, Donald Trump would call reporters for years as John Barron. So it's very similar. Also a fictional person. In fact, it was Donald Trump. So who is advising him? And what about the fact that people like Elon Musk joined with the broligarchy of the other billionaires against what he was doing, attacked Navarro nonstop, calling him a moron and a sack of bricks, but said that was an insult to bricks?
Well, I mean, there is no one that he seems to be listening to. In many ways, Trump is giving protectionism a bad name. There is an argument that you can say that carefully constructed policies can help build particular industries.
So UAW President Sean Fain makes that argument.
Yeah. In particular industries, it has to be crafted. More important for developing countries than developed. We don't need that as much as a poor developing country. But sometimes you can use carefully crafted trade policies to do that. But his broad-based policies, his going after Canada, his going after the penguins, makes absolutely no sense. And what he's bringing back is the concern that we've had, that political economists have had for a very long time. It can be a source of corruption. When you negotiate in a non-transparent way, what happens is bribes get paid. You say, take off my tariff and I'll give you money. Money either directly to you or to your campaign coffers. Mm-hmm. So we're going back into a non-transparent world where, for instance, the billionaire tech bros can help shape global tech policy in international trade to the detriment of the entire world. He's already done that. He's made a big deal about the EU changing its laws that try to create competition in the tech sphere to try to make sure that there's AI safety and social media safety, content moderation. He's attacked these fundamental laws, and all this is going to be going on in secret and with a lot of dirty stuff.
And just boast like he did the other night. I've got all these countries kissing my, I won't say it, but it rhymes with grass. You know what I mean?
Okay. And just before we conclude, Professor Chan, if you could give us an idea, what is happening in China? What are you hearing about how industries there are preparing for what's to come?
So China The voices in China are surprisingly calm. You know, the government's trying to strike a balance between preparing the people for economic pains to come and getting people into a mindset of solidarity. You know, they're blaming this entire, these tariff hikes on the Trump administration and the U.S. government. And people find that convincing in this case. At the same time, they're also trying to not stir up too much nationalism. So they've been really careful to actually censor how high the tariff hikes have been by the U.S. They've been careful. And, you know, my reading of what's going on is that they're creating space so that they can get out of this, right? So that there's a face-saving way to negotiate and get out of this trade war if an opportunity presents itself. And, you know, in the meantime, of course, the central bankers, the industries, everyone is lining themselves up for a deep and long trade war.
I want to thank you, Nancy Chen, for joining us, professor of economics at Northwestern University in Chicago, but joining us from Rome, Italy, and Joseph Stiglitz, the Nobel Prize-winning economist and professor at Columbia University. Coming up, we look at President Trump's latest threats to bomb Iran just days before the U.S. and Iran hold talks in Oman. Stay with us.
Well, I'm sitting over here on Parchment Farm. Well, I'm sitting over here on Parchment Farm. Well, I'm sitting over here on Parchment Farm, and I ain't never done no man no harm. Putting that cotton in an 11-foot sack. Well, I'm putting that cotton in an 11-foot sack. Well, I'm putting that cotton in an 11-foot sack with a 12-gauge shotgun at my back.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
The U.S. and Iran are planning to hold talks this weekend in Oman. President Trump made the announcement on Monday. He said direct talks will be held, while Iran said they would be indirect talks. Presidential envoy Steve Witkoff will head the U.S. delegation. Iran is sending its foreign minister, Abbas Araghchi. In 2018, Trump withdrew the United States from the landmark Iran nuclear deal, the JCPOA, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. On Monday, Trump directly threatened Iran when he was asked what will happen if a new nuclear deal is not reached.
If diplomacy fails, is the United States, under your leadership, ready to take military action to destroy the Iranian nuclear program and remove this threat?
I think if the talks aren't successful with Iran, I think Iran is going to be in great danger. And I hate to say it, great danger, because they can't have a nuclear weapon.
So is that a yes?
You know, it's not a complicated formula. Iran cannot have a nuclear weapon. That's all there is.
President Trump was sitting in the Oval Office on Monday with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu when he said that. Trump said Israel yesterday. He said Israel would take a leading role if the U.S. went ahead with striking Iran.
With Iran, if it requires military, we're going to have military. Israel will obviously be very much involved in that. He'll be the leader of that. But nobody leads us. We do what we want to do.
The Trump administration's also levied new sanctions against Iran, targeting its uranium enrichment program. We're joined right now by Nagar Mortazeh, the Iranian-American journalist, host of the Iran podcast, senior fellow at the Center for International Policy. Nagar, welcome back to Democracy Now!
Thanks for having me.
If you could start off by responding to what President Trump is threatening and what you know of these talks taking place in Oman on Saturday.
start. So, Amy, it seems like President Trump is kind of using his usual and specifically first-term playbook of what they have themselves coined peace through strength, or trying to get to the negotiating table or to diplomacy via threats, which in this case is military threats. We saw him do the same in his first term against Iran, with North Korea, with other parties that he wants to get to the negotiating table and feels like the other side doesn't come to the table. And so with threats and with pressure, he thinks he can force them. I think, though, the experience of the first Trump term, when it was maximum pressure on the other side, didn't really work with the Iranians and backfired. And there may have been some lessons learned. We see that he's fired some of the main figures of the maximum pressure Iran campaign, Mike Pompeo, John Bolton, Brian Hook. They're no longer with him. He's publicly disassociated with them. And so it seems like this time, his really intent on diplomacy, on a deal with Iran, on a deal that he's been trying to say is going to be a better deal, that the Obama era deal was a bad one, and his is going to be better. And potentially, I guess, a Nobel Peace Prize is something that he has his eyes on if he can get this nuclear deal with Iran, which he's called a nuclear peace deal. But at the same time, we've seen that it's difficult for him to get to the negotiating table with the Iranians. And so the pressure and these threats are also coming with it parallel. So it's a strange methodology to try to convince the other side with threats and pressure. And that's one of the reasons the Iranians are not willing to sit down directly and negotiate directly. And this emphasis on indirect negotiations is because they're also saying, look, you want to negotiate and have diplomacy, which is something Tehran has indicated they want as well. But at the same time, you're increasing maximum pressure. Just yesterday, as you said, Amy, they put on more sanctions on Iran. Since he came into office, he signed a memorandum of maximum pressure to tighten sanctions and pressure on Iran. And there have been periodic sanctions imposed on the Iranians. So it's not exactly the best way to get to the negotiating table. But nevertheless, this is his style. And the Iranians have played ball to meet with them on Saturday in Oman. But that's one of the main reasons it's going to be indirect, because the Iranian side is basically signaling that they want to see some goodwill. They also want to understand the framework and the U.S.'s bottom line of what it is that they want. Because if you listen to President Trump and, for example, Steve Witkoff, the structure or the framework they've talked about is Iran not having nuclear weapons. Just not having nuclear weapons, which is something Tehran has agreed to before, and they've actually said they don't want nuclear weapons. But if you listen, for example, to National Security Advisor Michael Waltz or Benjamin Netanyahu going out of the White House and some other people in that orbit, they're saying a dismantlement, an entire dismantlement of Iran's nuclear program. Basically, Iran can't have a nuclear program, period. So which is it? I think that is also going to sort of show the way on Saturday to the Iranians.
So, Nigar, also, if you could talk about what the situation is, the economic context in which these negotiations are taking place in Iran, the enormous economic pressure that's been brought to bear on Iran over all these years of sanctions now exponentially multiplied, and the fact that in an unprecedented move, the Iranian president, Masoud Pezeshkian, has said that if a deal is reached, American companies could come and invest in Iran.
Sure. So let me start with the latest. The Iranian president, again, exactly as you said, unprecedented, has said that the supreme leader himself is open to American companies coming to Iran and investing. And this is, again, signaled to President Trump, because his criticism, one of his main criticisms of the JCPOA, President Obama's legacy nuclear deal with Iran, was that the Europeans were reaping all the benefits and not Americans. And this is mainly, it's not something that Iran has started. It's something that American companies can't do because of very strict U.S. sanctions. American companies can't have trade with Iran or any form of investment because of the punishment that the U.S. government will impose on them in the form of sanctions. In fact, secondary sanctions now have prevented other companies around the world, Europeans, Asians, many others, to these sanctions if they do trade with Iran. So if that's something that President Trump wants, he can change that. Iran had a deal to buy airplanes, passenger airplanes from Boeing, and even that was stopped from happening, which essentially Boeing took an economic hit for that. As far as the economic situation in Iran, well, the economy is in pretty bad shape, declining as a direct result of these harsh economic sanctions. Iran is one of the most, if not the most, one of the most sanctioned countries in the world right now by the U.S., as I said, these primary and secondary sanctions, which even punish non-American companies who do trade with Iran if you buy Iranian oil, gas. As a result of that, Iran has a lot of its assets sitting in reserves, basically blocked outside the country. For example, the Iraqis buy a lot of energy from Iran, but they owe the money in billions to Iran because the U.S. doesn't allow them to pay Iran back. And so it's a combination of this cutoff. Iran's being cut off from the world economy, or most of it, that has really impacted the state of affairs and the living situation for ordinary Iranians, working class, middle class Iranians. The life, basically, their
purchasing
power has shrinked.
Nigar, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Nigar Mortazevi is an Iranian-American journalist, host of the Iran podcast, senior fellow at the Center for International Policy. Of course, we'll cover this more following the talks in Oman on Saturday. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
There's a nip in the air. It's the chill of fear and despair that is all too familiar to me. The recent Columbia graduate student Mahmoud Khalil's detention by Immigration and Customs Enforcement on Saturday has brought back my most tormenting childhood nightmares as a child of Holocaust survivors in communist Romania in the 1950s. Those are the words of our next guest, Mariana Hirsch, professor emerita at Columbia University. In her recent article headlined, "I grew up under a terrifying authoritarian regime. Mahmoud Khalil's arrest is right out of their playbook." The article was published in the Jewish newspaper, The Forward.
Mariana Hirsch joins us today in studio. She's the author of several books, including The Generation of Post-Memory, Writing in Visual Culture After the Holocaust. Professor Hirsch, welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. You said the conditions for Mahmoud Khalil's arrest were created by Columbia, and then put that into the larger context, you having come out of authoritarian Romania.
Well, I grew up in Romania until the age of 12. My parents were survivors of the Romanian Holocaust. And when Mahmoud Khalil was abducted, when Rumeza Ozturk was abducted, and I watched those videos, it brought back these feelings of terror that I grew up with as a child, the helplessness in front of seemingly all-powerful forces that couldn't be stopped, that were arbitrary, and that had only the barest rationale for, or no rationale, for these arrests. I think the condition for these arrests have been created by our universities. Unfortunately, Columbia, where I teach and where I've taught for 20 years, was the model for this. And the way they've been created is, first of all, by accepting and then promoting the big lie that anti-Semitism is driving protests against the brutal genocidal war in Gaza, of Israel on Gaza, that these are anti-Semitic protests of excluding and suspending student groups, of draconian measures of punishment, but also of casting protesters as terrorists, which is now expanding. And what I'm seeing is spread is the kind of helplessness that I felt as a child and that I picked up from my surroundings, the fear of speaking, the suspicion that one can be denounced, that there are lists out there, that we don't know who's on the lists, that there's nothing that can be done to help. And I'm seeing my students silence themselves, being afraid to speak, wondering who might be denouncing them, who might be making lists. And let's be real. I mean, Mahmoud Khalil was chosen by Colombia to be a mediator between the administration and the student protesters. And then he was denounced by, unfortunately, I have to say, people at Colombia. There's a Intercept report that I'm sure you're aware of, that there's a group of parents, alumni, and even some faculty who are making lists of students who could be deported or who are aliens, enemies of the state, of the university. And this idea of denunciation is something that I've carried from my childhood, because my father would often come home saying that he was asked by his superiors at work whether he would name the names of people who, whatever. I mean, there was always a reason for this, and how he refused, and how, you know, he gave up some possibilities of advancement by refusing to name those names. So this is something I was carrying. But there is a difference. You know, we have laws. This is illegal. And there are possibilities of appeal. And there are also ways in which this narrative, this big lie of rampant anti-Semitism that universities have accepted and even promoted by forming task forces on anti-Semitism, I think that people who are now seeing, Jerry Nadler is a great example, that this might not have been such a good idea, because it's brought upon us this terrible repression under the guise of fighting anti-Semitism. And I think people are now seeing that this is not just morally completely wrong and corrupt, but that it's also not good for Jews, certainly, but it's that it's not good for anybody, and that the reason for this was never to fight anti-Semitism, but it was to decimate academia.
And if you could talk, you've also written a piece on the extent to which and the speed with which Colombia completely capitulated or submitted to the Trump administration's demands. You wrote a piece headlined, There's a Bleak Historical Explanation for Why Colombia's Capitulation to Trump is So Concerning, in which you write, quote, "We are not living in early Nazi Germany, but although as a student of fascism and the Holocaust, I've learned to be careful with such comparisons, some resonances are too obvious to ignore." What are those resonances?
Well, the resonances are that autocratic regimes go after education. I mean, certainly higher education. Why? Well, academic freedom, self-governance, inquiry, open inquiry, the possibility that we might promote a narrative of history that is true but that doesn't conform to the vision of the autocrat. All of those things are extremely threatening, and we've seen it not just in early Nazi Germany, but certainly in Hungary, in Turkey, in India, the crackdown on universities. But what's more concerning to me is the response of universities and how they've not just anticipatory obedience, but really anticipatory capitulation, first through these task forces and accepting the anti-Semitism narrative, but then agreeing to the demands, which are completely illegal and unreasonable demands, in the hope of pacifying the autocrat, which I think everybody already should know that that is not how you can deal. So what I'm not seeing is solidarity among universities, the willingness or the eagerness to fight back and to say, no way, we're not going to stand for this.
And finally, Mariani, you've worked on the transmission of memories of violence across generations, what you call post-memory. How do you see that? You've expressed concerns, in particular, Mahmoud Khalil's unborn child, the children of Gaza. How do you see this kind of being acted out now and in the future, all the violence that we see happening now? And also, I should mention the hundreds of student visas that we know of international students that have been revoked.
Well, this revocation, just to start with that, completely arbitrary, and students are not even informed, and the university is not informed. They find out through the online system, and then the ostracism of these students, which is what happened to me as a child, and certainly to my parents, of being denationalized, of being ostracized and publicly shamed for, you know, as a child, I was a pioneer with the red scarf, and I saw some of my classmates were their red scarves were removed, forcibly removed in front of the entire school when their parents applied for visas to leave, the country. So that's, something I carry as a child. But I'm also carrying what I call post-memory, which is memories of violence across generations that I inherited from my parents' stories. These are vicarious, but they feel like memories. And that's why I thought I needed a term for these very powerful fears and terrors that children, that we inherit for experiences that we didn't ourselves live, but that we feel like we remembered. So I guess the fear right now is that it's not only the children right now, but it's the, it's the future generations that will, how they will receive this moment of fear that is spreading across the country with people losing visas, losing status, even the stories of green card holders, but citizens possibly, and naturalized citizens like me, possibly being denationalized and like you. So I think the reverberations of this could reach future generations and